endings and beginnings today on The World. I'm Carol Hills in for Marco Werman, and we're celebrating the craft of the obituary writer. If you think that sounds like a downer, think again.
It's never depressing. Far from it. It's hugely uplifting because you write relentlessly about people who've done amazing things, and they have done amazing things at every stage in their lives.
Like the six Iranian students who traveled to London 200 years ago.
They were exploring Britain, exploring Europe for the first time. They were having to learn English. There were no dictionaries. There were no language books.
We've got their story today, plus the Turkish writer with a message for would-be ISIS recruits, and the UN refugee chief with a message for the world's diplomats, after the news. Today on the show, we're marking beginnings and endings. And to start, we're looking back at the origins of one of the biggest stories of 2015, the refugee crisis. Turmoil in the Mideast, especially the civil war in Syria, helped create an exodus that has spilled onto the world's doorsteps. Europe finds itself on the front lines, and by some accounts, it's a challenge that will define the year ahead, as the world's Matthew Bell reports.
Antonio Guterres is the United Nations refugee chief. When he started at the UN in 2005, the number of displaced people worldwide was about 38 million. 10 years later, 60 million people have been driven from their homes. And Guterres says it's important to remember the biggest reason why.
It's this dramatic multiplication of conflicts in the world. It's the fact that the international community has lost much of its capacity to avoid conflicts, to prevent conflicts, and then to timely solve them. And this is what needs, in my opinion, to have a surge in diplomacy for peace.
Guterres is at the tail end of his term as the top UN official for refugees. Looking back at the events of the past year, he says the European Union was totally unprepared when Syrian refugees started arriving in large numbers last summer.
Not only it was unprepared then, it's still unprepared today. And it was unable to put its act together, and the divisions in Europe do not allow for a European response to this situation. So the refugees came to the developed world, and that made it an issue in the global public opinion, in the international community's priorities. And that is probably the only positive thing about this tragedy. For the first time, political leaders all over the world took it seriously. The point is that we do not yet have an adequate response to that.
Guterres says about 1 million people crossed the Mediterranean into Europe this year. The EU has a population of more than 500 million people. So all in all, that's less than 2 refugees for every 1,000 residents of the European Union.
Now, if you go to Lebanon, you have 1 refugee for each 3 or 4 Lebanese. So it is clear that this problem could have been managed, but to be managed, it would be necessary to have all European countries assuming a common responsibility.
The mantra from the Chancellor of Germany has been just that. We can manage, Angela Merkel has been repeating. Germany has taken in by far the most refugees. This has become a contentious political issue there, but Merkel is resolute. In a New Year's address to the German public, she talked about the refugees as an opportunity.
Ich bin überzeugt, richtig angepackt ist auch die heutige große Aufgabe.
I am convinced, Merkel said, if we tackle the formidable task posed by the influx and integration of so many people in the right way today, then this will represent an opportunity for us tomorrow. The Chancellor said thank you to her fellow Germans for showing such willingness to help the refugees. She said this is a challenging moment in history, and she called on everyone in Germany to show unity.
Es kommt darauf an, dass wir uns nicht spalten lassen.
Merkel said it's important for the country not to allow itself to be divided, divided between generations or social classes, nor between those who have been in Germany a long time and those who are new. Then she warned the public not to follow those who, with coldness and even hatred in their hearts, say that Germany is for them alone. For The World, I'm Matthew Bell.
Coldness and hatred do not fill hearts in the Bavarian town of Abensberg, where Germans have largely welcomed refugees. But the latest influx has been a hardship. Abensberg has a population of 14,000 people, and now it's just added roughly 200 asylum seekers to the mix. The BBC's Jenny Hill reports on how Abensberg residents are dealing with the new arrivals.
Trip Tradition matters in Arbensberg. Its church towers and red-tiled rooftops cluster around a cobbled main square. Peer into one shop window here, and among the feathered caps and heavy woolen socks, you'll find lederhosen for babies. But Arbensberg is changing. On the edge of town, they're hastily building a refugee home. 14,000 people live here, so now do 200 asylum seekers, and counting. Ines is the newly appointed refugee coordinator, an efficient young woman who smiles a lot, even when I ask her how the town's coping.
The people, they came here, it's okay. But the next year, there will come more people, and that's not good. Wir schaffen das nicht.
This is the bottling room of Arbensberg's largest brewery. Brown bottles go rattling along a conveyor belt. They're filled with beer. It starts to froth over the top of the bottle, but just in time, the machine stamps down a cap. They've been brewing here since the year 1300. Leonard Salek stoops a little as he checks a vast copper vat full of bubbling liquid. His family have run this brewery for 8 generations, and he's no time for Angela Merkel's open-door refugee policy.
Of course, we must help the war refugees, but we should take fewer economic migrants. The politicians tell us they'll fill the gaps in the labour market, but the truth is that of 1 million people, only a third will get a job. The rest will be a burden to the welfare system.
Arbensberg is conservative country, but the local MP worries. Martin Neumeier points out that support's growing for Germany's populist anti-refugee party.
Arbensberg is rich. We can manage, but there are limits. We manage at a price, the price of social cohesion. If the same number of refugees arrives next year, then Germany will change. And many people here in Arbensberg, in Bavaria, don't want things to change. But that's impossible. It's a tug of war.
But for now, Arbensberg's new arrivals are settling in. I meet Rolav in the flat she shares with 2 other families. She's a biology teacher from Syria, and she tells me she feels welcome here. Have you encountered any difficulty as a Muslim moving somewhere like this?
I must accept the religion here and the tradition here. It's their country, and I come to this country. But also, I have my religion. I can't change it. It's mine, and my tradition also.
Arbensberg's Christmas market is busy. It's the end of an unprecedented year. What comes next will define not only this town, but Germany itself.
That's the BBC's Jenny Hill from the German town of Arbensberg. One thing that's fueling the refugee crisis is ISIS and its ability to find recruits. That prompted Mustafa Akyol to try to reach out to those who might heed the ISIS call. He's a writer and journalist in Istanbul. Akyol wrote an open letter to his fellow Muslims for the Doha-based broadcaster Al Jazeera.
Well, this letter is written to somebody who could be inspired by ISIS. And instead of demonizing that somebody, which is probably some disillusioned Muslim in some corner of the world, I want to build a bridge. I want to say, I understand your concern for our religion, Islam. I understand your concern to do something about it, and I actually respect it. And if you channel this into a constructive path, like becoming a successful young Muslim individual who, with his work, will do something for our faith, that'll be great. But then I'm opening up to the dark side. I'm saying, beware of the dark side, and here is why.
And what is that dark side where Muslims are concerned, in terms of Muslims who somehow decide that ISIS is the right thing?
The dark side is the violent side. And that violence, first of all, comes from the concept of jihad, struggle in Islam. But then the first thing I say is that, well, first of all, this is a bastardized interpretation of jihad. Because, yes, Islam has a notion of holy war. We should be honest about that. But this was mainly a defensive war in the first place. Secondly, it never meant attacking women, children, non-combatants. Islamic armies fought with other armies in the Middle Ages. Jihad was something between soldiers. It never meant going and killing innocent people, as just ISIS or Al-Qaeda have been doing in the past couple of decades. So I'm just first pointing that this is not jihad. This is just wanton murder. This is brutality.
Have you ever engaged directly with a young man or woman who is interested in ISIS, who somehow thinks it's the right way?
Not ISIS, but I've met people who are inspired by other radical groups. ISIS is really new. In the past 3 years it came out. And in Turkey, you really don't see people who are really very pro-ISIS. There were just a few people who joined openly, and then a couple of fighters, a couple of thousands of fighters, but you don't engage them in person. But I've engaged in people who sympathize with bin Laden, who also maybe were not sympathetic to Al-Qaeda, but sympathetic to other groups that are really radical and on borderline, maybe, violent. So it's a narrative that I know, and I also sometimes engage with these people on the internet, too. I mean, I get feedback on what I write, and maybe they're not members of ISIS, but they are somewhat sympathetic, and you can have certain conversations with these people.
When you do so, do you think there's any real engagement, or is it you're saying one thing and they're saying the other and you're sort of talking across each other?
Well, I mean, if people are really into ISIS, they're mainly made up their mind and it's really hard to penetrate in their cultural universe. But if there's something that will penetrate, it's this kind of message, I believe. It's a message not that looks at Islam from the outside. Or just you know, critique of extremism, you know, is in a very, you know, cliche way, but which will really cut down to the matter and say, why are you finding ISIS interesting? Why are you finding it appealing? Think of your motives. Because in Islam, there is actually a great emphasis on motives. What motivates you? Are you motivated by the will to serve God and do something righteous? Or are you motivated by something else? And that's an actually important discussion in all Islamic circles. And I think by underlining that issue of when you are drawn into ISIS, are you really drawn to serve God, or are you drawn to achieve power, fame, and glory? I hope I pushed a button which might maybe help some people to rethink their inclinations.
Mustafa Akyol is a Turkish journalist. He wrote an open letter to a future ISIS recruit. Thanks, Mustafa.
Thanks. It was my pleasure to be on the show.
Before we head to a break, here's a song we loved in 2015. It's by the duo Ibeyi.
No one is wrong or right. I want to end our fight. Let's dance our way into the light.
Now, the word Ibeyi means twins in the West African language of Yoruba. Kayende Diaz and her twin sister Naomi are connected to that culture through their famous father, Miguel Diaz, who was a percussion player for the legendary group Buena Vista Social Club. We spoke to Lisa and Naomi earlier in the year, and they shared stories of their dad, stories about being twins, and of course their self-titled CD. Ibeyi made it onto our list of favorite releases this year. You can find the entire list at PRI.org. And later in the program, we'll play another of our favorites. The music of Ibeyi. This is the world. I'm Carol Hills, and it's the world. 2015 was not a banner year for religious harmony. Anti-Muslim sentiments continued to simmer throughout the U.S. and Europe, while in much of the Mideast, anger toward the West and its predominant religions deepened. But there's nothing predestined about the animosity, at least according to UCLA history professor Niall Green. Green's new book tells the story of six young Muslims who managed to find their way in London 200 years ago. It's called The Love of Strangers.
Well, the stories of the first group of Muslims ever to come to study in Europe And they arrived in the fall of 1815, and they found themselves in the midst of the society described by Jane Austen in her novels.
And briefly, what is the society like? What's the kind of vibe or feel in London at that time?
Well, as Jane Austen describes it, of course, this is a period of great decor, of great civility, of balls, of course, of figures like the Mr. Darcy's of her novels. But, of course, there's a very different society simmering behind the scenes of Pemberley and the decorous settings of her novels. And, of course, that's a society which is being transformed by two great processes of industrialization on the one hand and imperialism on the other hand. And so, in many ways, I see the diary written by the student Mirza Saleh, the Persian diary which forms the basis of my book, as being in many ways a contribution to England's literature, if not English literature, in that it shows the broader society going on behind the scenes of Jane Austen's novels.
Tell us about this diary and how you got a hold of it.
The diary is printed in Persian. It's never been translated into English. And I simply found it by doing what historians do, browsing through the bookshelves of a library. And what the diary does is effectively gives us the personal and the first-hand account of what this group of six young Muslims got up to during their 3.5 years in London, and indeed the travels they did around the rest of England in that time. It tells us about the adventures and the misadventures of these six young men on their quest for learning, on the one hand, the official reason for their visit, but also of the friendships, in some cases the love affairs, and the many meetings with all kinds of people that they had during that period, which is pretty much the same amount of time that would be an undergraduate degree today.
Why were these six Iranians sent abroad to London in the first place?
The period of around 1815 was the period in which Iran in particular, but also other regions in the Middle East, such as the Ottoman Empire, were facing the aggressive expansion of the Russian Empire. So Iran, as well as the Ottoman Empire, developed a policy of modernization. They called it the Nizam-i-Jadid, the New Order. And as part of that new order that was originally military-led, the idea was to strengthen the military of both Iran and the Ottomans against the Russian Empire. For that reason, the Iranians and then later the Ottoman and Egyptian governments sent young men to study the new sciences in Europe. But even though that, if you like, that military motivation was the official reason of the government sponsors of the Iranian students, when they found themselves in England, they actually decided to, they had to create their own syllabi, their own paths of study. And they ended up studying all kinds of things that their sponsors had never imagined. They developed a taste for romantic poetry. They rather liked the exotic Orientalist poetry that was fashionable in their day, the poems of Lord Byron and the Lord Aruch of Thomas More. And they also came to study the political and constitutional forms of modern democratic government as we know it now in the West.
Can you get a sense from the diary of the first impressions of these Iranians when they land in England?
Yeah, when they first arrived, they were pretty well bewildered. We have to remember that this was a period only 200 years ago when, certainly for the Middle East and Muslims more broadly, there was very little, hardly any real direct contact with Europe. Certainly there was a level of experience of Europeans in places like India. But when the students first arrived on Britain's shores, they didn't speak English. There were no Persian accounts, or hardly any Persian accounts of Britain whatsoever, or indeed of Europe altogether. So they were really, in a sense, this was first contact. They were exploring Britain, exploring Europe for the first time. They were having to learn English. There were no dictionaries. There were no language books. So in many ways, as they landed on the shores of the provincial port of Great Yarmouth, they were not unlike many of the refugees we find arriving on the shores of Europe today, except in many ways they had far less knowledge, of course, from television or from other media than any of those Muslim migrants would have today.
And of course they had a sponsor and were kind of hosted to some degree. How were they received?
Their sponsor or their host was a fellow called Mr. Darcy. So this isn't the Darcy of Jane Austen's novels, of course, who was a fictional character, but he's the, you know, the real living Mr. Darcy of that period. And he was a gentleman, and like many of the fictional heroes of Jane Austen, he was a dashing young soldier as well, who had actually served in Iran, in fact, helping the Iranian government defend themselves against the Russians. So Darcy was their chaperone and their first helper, and he set them up in his bachelor pad on Leicester Square, so still pretty much London's entertainment district today. They were received in London surprisingly well, according to Ms. Asale's diary. They found themselves, eventually they found themselves hosted by many of the great and good across Britain, including some of the most famous novelists and literary figures and literary hosts and hostesses of the day. In fact, figures who were more influential and famous than even Jane Austen was in her own day.
Did the Brits that they dealt with treat them as kind of exotics and, ooh, this is so interesting, or was there sort of a genuine exchange?
Certainly, I think there was a level of exoticization about them. They were, and I think they played up to that as well. When they went to Bath to take the waters, and they went there, in fact, in the same year that Jane Austen's Persuasion was published, which, of course, is set in Bath, and they paraded around the city in these fur-lined cloaks, which were called in English a pelisse, and a pelisse was a, you know, the most hot item of kind of clothing in 1818, and crops up in Jane Austen's novels. Jane Austen's museum, actually in England, actually has a pelisse that supposedly belonged to Jane Austen herself. So I think they were to some extent they were certainly, I think, in many ways welcomed as high status strangers. They were, I think, to some extent exoticized, but I think they also knew how to manipulate those fashions for their own purposes as well, because, of course, they were trying to make their way.
What was the most surprising thing you found out after reading this diary?
I think in many ways, perhaps the more surprising things I felt, the most surprising things I found were the level of warmth and contact, and even ultimately love affairs, and ultimately at the end of the book, even a marriage that takes place between one of the students and the people they meet in Britain. After all, I think violence and conflict always capture the headlines for historians as well as journalists in the past as well as the present. But I wanted to look behind the headlines and tell, I think, the more ordinary and quotidian everyday story of people rubbing along and getting along, and in some ways to redress the balance of the headlines by looking behind them.
Niall Green teaches at UCLA. His new book is called The Love of Strangers, What Six Muslim Students Learned in Jane Austen's London. Thanks for speaking with us, Niall.
Thank you very much, Carol.
You're listening to The World. I'm Carol Hills. Still to come, meet Ella Perkis. She's voted. She's sat on juries.
I have passed security clearance to work in nuclear plants. I've passed security clearance to work on Air Force bases.
Only she's not a citizen, and she's not alone. Ella's story plus the lost art of the euphemistic obituary. Ahead on The World.
The World is brought to you by Public Radio International with support from TIAA CREF, a global financial company that's created to serve and built to perform. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Carol Hills, in for Marco Werman, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. One of the most sobering stories of 2015 has been the continuing saga of the nearly 300 schoolgirls kidnapped in Nigeria. The Islamic extremist group Boko Haram abducted the teens nearly 2 years ago. The cry taken up around the world then was, "Bring back our girls." When Nigeria's new president, Muhammadu Buhari, took the helm in May, he promised to do all he could to get the girls back to their parents. And yesterday, Buhari announced that he's ready to negotiate with Boko Haram without preconditions for the schoolgirls' release. But the Nigerian leader admits he lacks solid intelligence on the teens' whereabouts. So I asked the BBC's Abdullahi Kaur Abubakar for an update. He's in Nigeria's capital, Abuja.
All we know is that on the day the abduction took place, over a dozen of them were able to escape. After those ones, there haven't been others that managed to escape. There are over 200 of them that are still in captivity. All we hear are reports of them being separated, being kept in different places. Some of them have been married off to to members of the militant group. We hear that some of them are already bearing children. Some of them have died through snake bites. Some of them were sick. These are all the stories that we've been hearing, but nobody can really say whether or not they are true.
Remind us why the girls were taken in the first place.
Well, you know, the group, Boko Haram itself, the name Boko Haram means Western education is forbidden. They use abductions, you know, as a way of recruiting people into the group. Male, you know, youngsters, girls, you know, little children. They use the forced, or rather they conscripted the male, I mean, the young men they took into the group and turned them into fighters, while the girls also became their wives or their sex slaves, or even some of the abducted girls became fighters themselves.
Now, President Buhari has said he's willing to negotiate with Boko Haram with no preconditions, as long as they can establish who a real leader of Boko Haram is, as long as they have somebody credible to speak to. Is there anybody credible? Is that likely to happen?
Well, yes, it is likely to happen. I mean, it all depends on how sincere the government is. It all depends on how much the group is ready to believe what the government says, because in the past, the group was ready to negotiate with government for a ceasefire, and rather than do exactly that, the government lured some of the leaders to come out, and they were arrested or killed while trying to get to where the negotiations were to take place.
The Bring Back Our Girls campaign was really huge in Nigeria and all around the world. How much popular concern remains today in Nigeria for these girls?
Well, that concern is still there. The group is still there, except that they are not as active as they used to be during the previous regime. Perhaps the reason might be that the previous regime did not give them any listening ear at all. The previous regime was not ready to talk to them. Rather, it saw them as part of the opposition.
So it just got turned into political yammering and not
yes,
anything significant.
The whole issue was turned into politics. But when this present administration came in, it invited the group to the presidential villa where they talked and they presented their concerns to the president, and he promised them he will do something. But with the announcement yesterday that up to this moment, there is no intelligence report suggesting where these girls might be, you know, the whole thing has come crashing on the group. One of the members of the group was here in our studio this afternoon, and where she said they are really, really scared because they don't know what to do next.
The BBC's Abdullahi Kaur Abubakar is in Nigeria's capital, Abuja. Thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you very much.
Well, we've done it. We've made it through another year. That means it's time to look back and celebrate the lives of a few of those we've lost along the way. It doesn't have to be a glum task, at least not according to Harry de Ketville. He's the former obituaries editor for the British newspaper The Telegraph.
It's never depressing. Far from it. It's hugely uplifting because you write relentlessly about people who've done amazing things, and they have done amazing things at every stage in their life. So if you are a middle-aged man like I am, and you think here is the onset of midlife crisis, you constantly surrounded by people who are also middle-aged once, but went on to become heroes in later life and, you know, wrote their magnum opus when they were 93. So you're constantly surrounded by how wonderful humans can be. And that's not always the case in newspapers. So people achieve incredible things, and they do them at all stages in life. And that's uplifting, not depressing.
So how do you decide who to write about? I know you're as fond of obits about not so famous people. So who decides?
Well, the obituaries editor decides, and that's why it's such a great job, because it contains a fair element of the dictator's powers. You know, if people strike your interest, then you write about them. I mean, inevitably, there is a certain level of fame where you are obliged and the readers demand it. But ultimately, anything that sparks the reader's interest is the threshold that you have to cross.
So give us an example of someone you decided to write an obit about that maybe another editor wouldn't have decided.
Well, the Telegraph is famous for obits of eccentric figures. We once did an obit about a chap whose name momentarily escapes me, but imagine he was called John Viner, for instance, and the obit began, John Viner, who has died aged 73, excelled in teaching lions how to ride motorcycles, and he was a circus performer, and I just think that kind of thing immediately grasps the attention and readers' eyes light up. I mean, if you can accompany it with a photograph of a lion riding a motorcycle, all the better.
What about the whole issue of what a person was really like? You can write an obit and lots of people who are real jerks sound really great. How do you get around that issue?
Sometimes I would say that it's not our job to get around it. It may even be our job to signal that. Obituaries, perhaps when they started out in British newspapers, had a certain code, which became so famous that it was almost no point at all that you would say someone was a bon vivant, you know, if they're an alcoholic drunk, and you would say that they enjoyed the company of women if they were basically assaulting everyone they saw. And it was just, you know, there was a sort of code, and you could say someone, I mean, famously might say someone was a confirmed bachelor if they were gay. And those days have rather passed now. But when it comes to how people behave and act, if they're real jerks, as you say, then you tell an anecdote which makes that perfectly clear. And there are several famous Telegraph obits where almost the entire obit is about just how ghastly people are.
Tell us about one of your favorite obits.
Well, one of my favorite, which just goes to show the point that you don't have to be a glorious and soul and a great achiever to feature in the obituaries column, is that of the 7th Marquess of Bristol, who was known as Lord Harvey, and he died a young man. He inherited vast wealth and spent it. The obit notably says that at one of his own soirees, frustrated by his inability to open a fridge for some champagne, he blew the door off with a shotgun. At another party, he demolished a 500-glass champagne fountain by tying a piece of cotton thread between it and a duchess's chair. On another occasion, he lent an American woman a rubber dinghy to fish in the lake at Ickworth, then fired at it until it sank. The more she screamed, the more he laughed. He was clearly a deeply unpleasant man, but that's not always a bad thing when it comes to obits.
What would you like your own obituary to say?
Ah, it's hard for anyone to imagine their own death and reflect upon it. I don't know. I hope that it would give my journalistic career in the round, but above all, that I enjoyed myself in living my life, and I think that is the crucial thing that comes out in great lives, is that people feel that they have lived every moment and really pushed themselves. So I suppose that's all that one can hope for from one's own life, as well as, of course, teaching lions how to ride motorcycles.
Harry de Ketville served as the obituaries editor for the British newspaper The Telegraph, and he's edited a collection of those obits called Thinker, Failure, Soldier, Jailer, an anthology of great lives in 365 days. Thanks, Harry.
Thank you very much.
Obituary writer Heather Lendy faces a different sort of task from her base in the Alaskan town of Haines. She writes for the Chilkat Valley News, where she takes stock of those who've made life in her small town so vibrant.
Rural Alaska, Haines, where I live, is a lot like a foreign country in some ways. We come in and out via a ferry or a small plane from Juneau, and the ferry's about a 4.5-hour ride up the longest fjord in North America. The other thing about Haines that makes it really foreign in relationship to what I do as an obituary writer is our death rituals. We don't have a mortuary here or an undertaker. And the local ambulance crew will pick up a body at a house and keep it at the fire hall for 3 days. And while the body is there, friends or neighbors or volunteers prepare the body for burial. And often, family members even make their own caskets. You can buy a couple models at the local hardware store. And the reason I write obituaries, really, is because everybody helps with those death rituals, whether it's making casseroles or playing the music or typing up the funeral program. And as a writer, I realized that I could do the obituaries. About a year ago on Christmas Day, there was a woman named Polly Budke, and she was old and ill and had come home to die in hospice care, and her family was all around. And one of the last things she did was give them all instructions on how to properly roast the turkey. And I prefer, I think, when I'm writing these obituaries, to leave behind stories that resonate with people that may not have even known the person, or something that transcends maybe just even the story of their life. And with Polly, several people told me that she had given them traveling money when they went on a trip. She'd hear they were leaving and she'd send them a little card with $10 or $20 in it. And I love that. And it's something, you know, when you read that, you say to yourself, I'm going to do that. It's such an easy thing to do. And nowadays, you know, a coffee in the airport's $5 and a newspaper. And just sending someone with that little note just seemed a really nice thing. There was another woman that I wrote about. I was thinking about her. Her family owned the local grocery store for years. And there was just a beautiful line when I was writing her obituary that came from one of her nieces. And she said that Judy was her name. She said she really cared about children, and not just hers, but us, her niece and nephew, and the neighbor kids. And she said she'd take the children out at night to look at the stars and explain things to us, anything we wanted to know. And I love that image. I want to be, I think, that kind of grandma or neighbor that takes the children out at night and looks at the stars and just answers anything they want to know. I am asked a lot about what makes a good life. And I think I've written now about 400 obituaries, all for people that I know and live with in this small town. Over the course of 20 years. And I think if I had to say one word, it really comes down to relationships. All of it is, when we go, do we leave people behind that will miss us? And it doesn't seem to matter if you were perceived as the most successful person in town. If people weren't really sad when you left, it seemed like you've missed an opportunity in your life. And now I think about that a lot in the way I live. I think, you know, am I generous? Am I kind? Am I grateful? Those are the things that make a good life. And do I care about people? One friend told me that, and I've found this to be true in writing obituaries, that if you want to have a lot of friends, that you have to be a good friend. And I take that to heart, and it's something that I have learned in writing obituaries.
Heather Lundy spoke with us from Haines, Alaska, where she writes for the Chilicat Valley News. Her latest book is called Find the Good: Unexpected Life Lessons from a Small Town Obituary Writer. And we'll hear from Heather again before we wrap up today. A little nostalgia trip for you now. If you tuned into the world 20 years ago tomorrow, this is what you would have heard.
Happy New Year, and welcome to our first edition.
On today's program, the legacy of 4 years of war in Bosnia.
Also these stories: it's only rock and roll, but the French government doesn't like it, if it's not French.
And the trials and tribulations of becoming a U.S. citizen.
And that lady cried and cried until she learned, and she passed. She's already a citizen.
Those stories and more coming up today on The World.
Wow, that takes me back. Tony Khan and Eddie Mayer introducing our first broadcast on January 1st, 1996, with yours truly in the producer's chair that day. Tomorrow on The World, we'll dip into the archive for a little look at how the world has and hasn't changed over the past two decades. Our executive producer, Andrew Sussman, has also been with us from the start, though not in the corner office back then. You can read his reflections on our 20th anniversary, illustrated with a photo of a very youthful Marco Werman, at PRI.org. I'm Carol Hills, and it's The World. Before 2001, when Americans adopted children from overseas, the parents had to take the legal steps to get their kids naturalized and become U.S. citizens. But in several thousand cases, that never happened, and that's left some international adoptees who are now well into adulthood essentially stateless. And for a small number who've committed crimes here, it's meant deportation. Kaomi Getz has the story.
Ella Perkis was adopted from South Korea in 1956 when she was 2 years old.
My Korean name is Kim Yang Ai. I live in Pahrump, Nevada. I'm 61 years old.
Her Korean name is about all she knows about her life in Korea. She grew up here, got married, raised kids, and worked as an electrician. But recently she learned something that's shaken her.
I'm finding out a lot about myself that apparently my whole life has been a lie.
When her husband died last year, Perkis tried to collect Social Security benefits. That's when she found out she wasn't an American citizen. A big shock.
Because the adopted parents had raised me believing I was a naturalized citizen, even to the point of telling me how I sat on the judge's podium and he had talked to me. They even took pictures after we had all the supposed swearing in had taken place.
Perkis doesn't know why her adoptive parents lied, and she can't ask them since they're no longer living. But over the years, she was able to do things citizens do. She voted. She sat on juries.
I have passed security clearance to work in nuclear plants. I've passed security clearance to work on Air Force bases. I've also passed security clearance during the 9/11 to work on an Army base where we were building one of the factories they were going to destroy the weapons of mass destruction.
Perkis never got a U.S. passport. She never needed one. But her parents were supposed to make sure she was naturalized. It's something that Korea required for all international adoptions. But the adoption agency never followed up. Perkis isn't the only one in this situation. Adoptee advocates estimate as many as 15,000 or more children adopted internationally by Americans never received their U.S. citizenship, like Adam Krapser.
I wish that I would have never, ever, ever gotten in any trouble in my life. I wish that I could vote. I wish I was a U.S. citizen.
Krapser was adopted from South Korea as a toddler and endured repeated abuse by his American adoptive parents. He ended up on the streets and spent some time in prison for crimes he committed. His parents never naturalized him as a citizen. And when he tried to apply on his own behalf, the government saw his criminal record and flagged him for deportation. Krapser spoke to advocacy group Gazillion Strong earlier this year while he waited for a decision on his case.
America, you know, signed a bill to bring us over from Korea, you know, during a military action. They promised us a better life over here. All I'm asking, I would ask them to keep their promise.
Congress passed legislation in 2000 that gave international adoptees automatic citizenship, but it left out people like Adam Krapser and Ella Perkis, who arrived before the early 1980s. Kevin Vollmers of Gazillion Strong says he knows of at least 45 cases of adoptees deported to India, Brazil, South Korea, and other countries of origin for things like a minor drug offense. And that's not right.
We have an ethical obligation here in the United States to make sure these individuals have citizenship because that's what was promised to them. And so to take that part out, to say that certain adoptees don't deserve citizenship, is essentially questioning again the foundation of adoption, what it was built on.
Last month, U.S. Senator Amy Klobuchar of Minnesota introduced legislation to close the loophole. Neither she nor any of the other sponsors would comment for this story. But even advocates concede the bill faces an upward battle. It creates a pathway for some of the deportees to return, and critics might portray it as soft on crime. For now, Ella Perkis remains in limbo. She says she's running out of money. That's because authorities have so far denied her Social Security claims over questions about her status.
It's sad to think that small children, 2.5 and 3 years of old, people can just take them from a foreign country, drop them into another country. Nobody guarantees that that child is a citizen of anywhere.
Perkis applied for citizenship last spring, but a few days ago, the federal government denied her application. Authorities told her she waited too long to be naturalized. So Perkis remains a permanent U.S. resident without a passport from any country. She's now reached out to congressional representatives for help because at this point, she says legislation may be her only hope. For the world, I'm Kayomi Getz.
As 2015 comes to a close, we want to dip into our list of favorite music released this year and highlight just one more track. The high point, Ghanaian High Life from Pat Thomas. Pat Thomas has been a mainstay on the Ghanaian music scene for 50 years, but for the last decade, he's been rather quiet. That is until this release in June, his first album in more than 10 years. And for the occasion, he enlisted help from a few of his musician pals, mainly Ghanaian Ibo Taylor and Nigerian drummer Tony Allen. Pat Thomas is in his 70s now, and for a man who was once voted the golden voice of Africa at the prime of his career, 2015 proved to be a much welcome comeback.
Yeah, I can be near,
That's Pat Thomas. He made it onto our list of favorite music released in 2015. You can check out the full list at PRI.org. And before we wrap our final show of the year, we wanted to leave you with one last thought about endings and beginnings as we reflect on the year just gone and the one about to start. It comes to us from the obituary writer in Alaska we heard from a few minutes ago, Heather Lendy.
I think when you write about death, it can be kind of grim or morbid or sad. But when you live in a place that is so grand and so eternal in a way, you know, the mountains and the glaciers and the trees and the rivers and that cycle of the salmon returning to spawn every year and heading out to the ocean and coming back to die, you realize that you're all part of a big old wheel of life that's turning up here. And so I don't find death as depressing, perhaps, as maybe some people do, because I can see the sort of continuous cycles of nature and death and rebirth, and you see it in the landscape here, and in the winter and spring and summer and fall. It's, I mean, you kind of have to be have your head in a snowbank to miss that. It's remarkable.
Head duly removed from snowbank. So happy New Year's Eve from all of us here at The World. I'm Carol Hills, and from the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston. Thanks for listening.
PRI, Public Radio International.